We've been looking at stories from the lives of the people mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 as part of our larger study through the book of Hebrews. And Hebrews chapter 11 is a chapter devoted to the subject of faith. And the people mentioned in this chapter all exemplified faith in God. The last person mentioned by name, which we have been looking at, is David. Today is our last installment of David's story. The Lord chose David over all of the people in Israel to be the king because the Lord said he was a person after God's own heart. We noted at the beginning of our study of David that Psalm 23 expresses the heart attitude of David that explains why God said David was a person after his own heart. The key idea is in the opening sentence of David's poem, "The Lord is my shepherd." This is how David saw the Lord, as his shepherd, his provider, his protector, his comforter, his guide, his master, the one who leads him to peaceful places, the one who feeds him, the one who keeps him safe, the one who rescues him from trouble, the one who guides him through life, the one who overwhelms him with goodness and love, and the one that David desired then to serve and to please above all others. Now, although David was a person after God's own heart, he was not perfect. He was a human being, just like you and me, with the same kinds of struggles and flaws that we have. This final story from David's life, which we'll be looking at today, is about a sin that he commits in his latter years. Sadly, we are never too old or too far along in our journey to not do something stupid. And so we're always dependent on the grace and the mercy of the Lord from our first day to our last day. Psalm 73:26 says, "My flesh and my heart may fail, and indeed they do. But God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." He's the one that we depend on and trust in, not ourselves, not our performance, not how good or bad we are, but how good and faithful the Lord is. Amen? Well, you can make your way over to 2 Samuel chapter 24. 2 Samuel chapter 24, it's the very end of the book, the last chapter of 2 Samuel. Now, before we get into this story, I want to remind us of the cultural context in which these events take place. It is the ancient Middle East. It's not modern-day America. There will be some things in this story which are going to sound strange, perhaps even offensive, to our modern Western minds. But remember that in the times that these events took place, all of this was consistent with the way people understood things and the way they lived out their lives at that time. Don't let the strangeness of some of the things that take place in this story distract you from the good stuff that we can learn from it, okay? That really goes for a whole lot of the Old Testament, but I want to say it in particular today so that the story is not ruined for you because you're looping on some weird thing in this story. This story takes place, as I said a moment ago, during the latter part of David's reign as king. Verse 1 says, "Again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, 'Go and take a census of Israel and Judah.' So the king said to Joab and the army commanders with him, 'Go throughout the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and enroll the fighting men so that I may know how many there are.'" Now, these first couple of verses are a bit confusing. A quick surface reading appears to say that the Lord has caused David to commit a terrible sin in order to punish the people of Israel. That's not quite what's going on. We know that can't be quite right because it conflicts with what we know about the Lord in other places of the Bible. For example, in James chapter 1, verse 13, it says, "When tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they're dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death." The Lord does not entice or cause people to sin. People sin when they are enticed, tempted, led astray, dragged away by their own evil desires. And there is one who helps us along with being dragged away by our desires, the enemy of our soul, the devil, Satan. Now, fortunately, we have a parallel account of this same story found in 1 Chronicles chapter 21. You don't need to turn there. I'm just going to point out a key piece of information from it for us today. The first couple of verses in that version of the story help us better understand what's going on here. 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1 says, "Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel." Well, that makes more sense to us and is more consistent with what we know about the Lord. So let's pull all of this together. The Israelite people have sinned against the Lord in some very severe way, which we are not told the details of. Whatever it was, though, it was so bad that God's judgment is coming against them because of it. The judgment will come against them through a sin that David commits, who is enticed by Satan, taking advantage of David's own evil thoughts and desires. Notice that it says in 1 Chronicles 21:1, Satan rose up against Israel. Satan is the great adversary, the great enemy of our souls. He wants to destroy every good thing God is doing in our world and in our lives. 1 Peter 5:8 says, "Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." And here we see the devil doing exactly that in this story. Well, what is David's sin that's being referred to here? Taking a census, counting the people, was not in and of itself a sinful thing to do. God himself had directed Moses to take a census of the people of Israel in Numbers chapter 1, and again in Numbers chapter 26, for example. The book of Numbers gets its name from the numbering and counting that takes place in the book. The process of counting is not a sin. The sin is in what the counting signifies and the reason for doing the counting. The law of God, given through Moses to the Israelites for them to live by, it taught in Exodus chapter 30, verses 11 and 12, that if they were to take a census, counting the able-bodied fighting men, each man was to pay the Lord a ransom for his life of a half shekel at the time he is counted. Otherwise, a deadly plague would come upon them. Now, as best as we can determine, the basic idea in the ancient world was that a person only had the right to count what belonged to them. The Israelites were the Lord's people, so only the Lord had the right to count them. By paying this ransom for each person that was counted, the Lord was, in a way, granting his permission for them to count what belonged to him. By ordering the counting of the able-bodied fighting men, David himself here is, in effect, usurping ownership over what was the Lord's. The Lord had not told David to count the men, and the ransom of a half shekel does not appear to have been paid by the men when they are counted in the story here. So David is putting his hands on what is not his by taking this census. Further, counting the able-bodied fighting men was usually only done when one wanted to measure the strength of their army. This is both in Israel and outside of Israel and other nations. David, then, counting the men, shows a king here trusting in the strength of his army rather than in the Lord. David is behaving like one of the godless pagan kings of the surrounding nations. David is living by sight rather than by faith in the Lord. David is finding his security and his confidence in what he thinks he has, his big army, rather than in what the Lord has promised to him. Now perhaps, we don't know this for sure, but perhaps the same attitude revealed in David is present too in the people of Israel as a whole and is at least part of the sin that they are also guilty of. They have become self-assured, trusting in their own strength rather than in the Lord. They have begun to take credit for what they have rather than remembering that who they are and what they have has all been given to them by the Lord. It's easy to do that too, isn't it? I mean, to take credit for things in our life that have been given to us by the Lord, to forget that who we are and what we have are gifts from the Lord, to forget that every good thing in our life comes from the Lord. David has forgotten the words of Psalm 33. Verse 16, it says, "No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all its great strength, it cannot save. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those whose hope is in his unfailing love, to deliver them from death and keep them alive in famine." Verse 3 of 2 Samuel 24, the story continues. It says, "But Joab, the commander of David's army, you might remember, replied to the king, 'May the Lord your God multiply the troops 100 times over, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my king, the Lord the king, want to do such a thing?'" Joab says, "We should not do this." The king's word, however, overruled Joab and the army commanders, so they left the presence of the king to enroll the fighting men of Israel. Joab doesn't want to do what David has ordered to be done. He knows that counting the men isn't right, that it is a sin. He tries to talk David out of it, but David overrules him and insists that he do it. So Joab and his men, they traveled throughout the land of Israel, and they counted all of the able-bodied men at least 20 years old. It took them almost 10 months to do it. And Joab returned to David and reported that there were well over 1 million men. Verse 10. David was conscience-stricken after he had counted the fighting men, and he said to the Lord, "I have sinned greatly in what I have done. Now, Lord, I beg you, take away the guilt of your servant. I have done a very foolish thing." David realizes that he's sinned greatly by having them counted. "I have done a very foolish thing." It was an extremely stupid, ill-advised, dumb as dumb can be thing that he has done. The NIV Bible says he was conscience-stricken. The ESV says he was heart-struck. The New King James says his heart condemned him. The Hebrews literally, he was struck in the heart. We've all felt that before, haven't we? After we have done something terrible, our conscience suddenly lights up with that horrible feeling of guilt. It's awful. And it is indeed like we've been struck in the heart. Now, you might be thinking, hold up, counting how many men he has in the army doesn't seem like that big of a deal. remember what it is revealing about David's heart and his attitude, where his head is at. He's trusting in himself rather than in the Lord. He's taking credit for what has been given to him by the Lord. He's laying claim to what is the Lord's rather than his. David's realization of his sin is immediately followed by a confession before the Lord. He asks the Lord to forgive him and to take away his guilt. And this is a character trait that we have seen before in David. He was not a perfect person. David did as many foolish things as we do. It wasn't moral purity and sinlessness that set him apart. What set him apart was his humble attitude when he became aware of and confronted with his sin. David didn't make excuses, explaining and justifying what he's done. He was truly remorseful, humbly owning it, confessing it, seeking forgiveness and reconciliation. Do you remember what David wrote in Psalm 32? We read this last time. When I kept silent, verse 3, he said, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy on me. My strength was sapped as in the heat of summer. Then I acknowledged my sin to you and did not cover up my iniquity. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord. And you forgave the guilt of my sin. The quickest way to silence our accusing conscience is to follow David's example of being truly remorseful, owning our sin, confessing it to the Lord, seeking forgiveness and reconciliation with him. Confessing our sin will not necessarily remove the consequences that come because of what we've done, as we'll see in this story too, but our all-important relationship with the Lord will again be a place of refuge and peace for us, even as we face the consequences. So in verse 11, before David got up the next morning, the word of the Lord had come to Gad the prophet, David's seer. Go and tell David, this is what the Lord says. I am giving you three options. Choose one of them for me to carry out against you. So Gad went to David and said to him, shall there come on you 3 years of famine in your land, or 3 months of fleeing from your enemies while they pursue you, or 3 days of plague in your land? Now then, think it over and decide how I should answer the one who sent me. You might remember Nathan had been the one given the task of confronting David over his sin of adultery and murder. Now the prophet Gad is given the task of going to David and confronting him with his sin. Through Gad, the Lord tells David he can choose between three options as consequence for his sin. 3 years of famine, 3 months of running from his enemies, or 3 days of deadly plague. Well, what will David choose? Can you imagine having to make a choice like this? I mean, there's no good options to choose from here. There will be tremendous suffering and loss of life with any of these choices. Now, we might be tempted at this point to question the severity of this judgment, but we shouldn't do that. We don't know all of the facts of what's been going on here. We don't know what sin Israel has committed that has brought this judgment against them. Remember, we were told at the very beginning of the story that there's more going on here than just David's sin. That there's a sin that the people of Israel have committed and been doing, and that's involved in all of this judgment too, see? Even though this story really focuses on David, his sin, and his interaction with the Lord here, in God's sovereignty, he's accomplishing a much larger thing in all of it. Verse 14, David said to Gad, I am in deep distress. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great, but do not let me fall into human hands. David is in great distress, agonizing over the choice he's faced with, knowing that his own foolish actions are going to bring terrible suffering upon others. And isn't that true for us too? Our sin rarely impacts only ourselves. It almost always brings suffering and trouble into the lives of others. You know, if we would remember that, it would help us to not sin. Unfortunately, in the moment of sinning, we rarely think of anyone but ourselves. It's only later when the consequences are coming down and we think, oh, I should have realized, I should have thought about that. I should have. David chooses 3 days of plague. And his choice gives us a look into the kind of faith David has in the Lord and the kind of relationship he has with the Lord. See, if David had chosen famine, he would have been forced to subject himself to other nations and depend on their mercy for food. If David had chosen fleeing from his enemies, he would have been subject to those who wanted to destroy him. A mysterious plague will make David and the people of Israel solely dependent on the mercy of God for relief. David says, let us fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is great. David will trust in the great mercy of the Lord. David knows the Lord will be compassionate and gracious, even in punishment and judgment. And that's an important idea that comes from this for us, is that God's punishment is to be preferred to man's mercy. God's punishment is to be preferred over man's mercy. So the Lord sent a plague on Israel from that morning until the end of the time designated, and 70,000 of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. An angel of the Lord began moving through the land of Israel, striking people down with this mysterious disease. And we learn from the account in 1 Chronicles that the people dying from this plague are from among the fighting men David had counted. So the very thing David had foolishly been placing his trust in, the size of his big army, is what is being lost. We're given an uncomfortable reminder of how uncertain the things of this world are that we trust in. Money, power, people, influence, it can all be taken from us in a moment. 16, when the angel stretched out his hand to destroy Jerusalem, the Lord relented concerning the disaster and said to the angel who was afflicting the people, enough, withdraw your hand. The angel of the Lord was then at the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. This angel was stretching his hand out over the capital city of Jerusalem when the Lord commanded him to stop. Enough, withdraw your hand. David was right. The Lord's mercy is great. Psalm 103:8, David wrote, the Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. He will not always accuse, nor will he harbor his anger forever. He does not treat us as our sins deserve or repay us according to our iniquities. When David saw the angel who was striking down the people, he said to the Lord, I have sinned. I, the shepherd, have done wrong. These are but sheep. What have they done? Let your hand fall on me and my family. David has a shepherd's heart for the people under his care. This was one of the things that made him such a great leader. David asked that himself and his family alone be punished rather than these people. He says, these are but sheep. David offering to take on the punishment for the sake of these sheep, it's a picture of Jesus Christ for us, isn't it? our good shepherd who has laid his life down for us. In the case of Jesus, being completely innocent and undeserving himself, willingly gave his life as a sacrifice for us and our sin. Verse 18, it says, on that day, Gad went to David and said to him, go up and build an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite. So David went up, as the Lord had commanded through Gad. And when Arunah looked and saw the king and his officials coming toward him, he went out and he bowed down before the king with his face to the ground. Arunah said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? To buy your threshing floor, David answered, so I can build an altar to the Lord that the plague on the people may be stopped. Arunah said to David, let my lord the king take whatever he wishes and offer it up. Here are the oxen for the burnt offering, and here are threshing sledges and ox yokes for the wood. Your majesty, Arunah gives all this to the king. Arunah also said to him, may the Lord your God accept you. So when Arunah learns what David is intending to do to build an altar to the Lord, he gives the threshing floor, he gives the land to David, he gives whatever else he might need, the oxen for the sacrifice, the threshing sledges and the yokes to be used as wood for the fire. He goes, hey, I'm just giving it to you, David. It's all yours, whatever you need. But look at verse 24. But the king replied to Arunah, no, I insist on paying you for it. I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen, and he paid 50 shekels of silver for them. David built an altar to the Lord there and sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then the Lord answered his prayer in behalf of the land, and the plague on Israel was stopped. David refuses Arunah's offer, saying, I insist on paying you for it. I will not sacrifice to the Lord my God burnt offerings that cost me nothing. David then paid Arunah the full market price for the land and everything else. What would it have said about David's love for the Lord and the people if he had taken these things Arunah offered to give him? Well, what would it say about my love for my wife if I gave her a wedding ring that I got from a gumball machine using a quarter that a friend gave me? David was not willing to settle for a cheap relationship with the Lord. And it raises some questions for us to consider. What do our acts of worship say about the importance of the Lord to us? What does the effort that we put into the relationship say about its importance to us? Is our relationship with the Lord a priority in our life, or just something that we tuck into the spare moments after everything else? How does the cost of the relationship reflect its importance to us? Are we giving our first fruits to the Lord or our leftovers? David refused to settle for a relationship with the Lord that cost him nothing. What about us? Let's not settle for a convenient, no-cost relationship with the Lord. If we do, we will get out of that relationship what we are putting into it. Not much. The Lord wants us to have a rich, full, vibrant life with Him, characterized by peace and joy. He spared no expense for us to be able to have that kind of relationship with Him. Let's not fail to embrace it. It's interesting to note that this plot of land that David purchases to build this altar, it's the very same spot where Abraham had offered his son Isaac to the Lord many years before in Genesis 22. And the Lord had provided a ram as a replacement sacrifice. It's also the same spot where the temple of the Lord is going to be built by David's son Solomon. This is how the land for the temple was acquired. This is it. In closing, Jesus said in Matthew 6:19, said, "Don't store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Let's make the Lord our greatest treasure and the greatest affection of our heart. Amen.